Hi, this is Paul. One of the biggest things to come out of the ARC conference was this panel discussion with Ion Hersey Ali. And I remember there at the moment, I was sort of watching things. I'd never paid a lot of attention to her. I had known her story. I had known how she went to the Netherlands and sort of had a real turning, and how she discovered that. I'd watched her conversation with Jordan Peterson, and I'd known the story. And then at the end of it, people were sort of saying, did she just come out as a Christian? Did she just say she was a Christian? Now, this has become, over the last couple days, one of the biggest stories on Twitter and sort of in the atheist Christian sphere. And I look forward to hearing Justin Brierley sort of enfold this into his podcast. I'm really loving Justin Brierley's podcast on his book. And it goes so far beyond his book because in many ways, Justin Brierley has lived this story for the last 17 years. And he knows all the quotes because he sat through most of them and he knows the people. And I think his podcast is really such a masterful taking all of these elements and putting them together in one coherent story. Well, let's talk about this event. And Rod Dreher wrote about this, and I'll just use the beginning of his piece because it sort of nicely gives a little bit of history in terms of who she is and why she's important. At the recent ARC conference in London, Ion Hersey Ali stunned the audience by mentioning, almost in passing, that she now identifies as a Christian. This was news, and this was exactly how it rolled out. I remember talking to some people at the coffee break after, and they'd say, did Ion Hersey Ali just call herself a Christian? And again, I really haven't paid that much attention. If you want to talk to someone who knows, talk to Esther. We're going to call her Esther anymore. Bethel McGrew, because she's followed all this stuff for a very long time, and she knows names, and she knows characters, and she knows all this far better than I do. I usually just check with her because she knows way more about it than I do. But people were just sort of, the Christians, and there were a lot of Christians, did she just sort of say she was a Christian? Hersey Ali shot to fame in 2002 when, as a Somali woman who had gained asylum in the Netherlands, where she had fled a decade earlier, escaping a forced marriage. Though once a pious Muslim radicalized in her youth by Saudi-funded teachers, by 9/11 terror attacks, and by her experiences translating for Muslim women seeking asylum, led Hersey Ali to re-examine her religion and renounce it. She became a member of the Dutch parliament and an internationally known critic of Islam, particularly the way Islam subjugates women. She had to go into hiding after jihadists issued death threats and slaughtered her film collaborator Theo van Gogh. Hersey Ali quickly became one of the leading figures in the New Atheist movement in the 2000s because it was dominated by white males from post-Christian Western culture. Think of Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins, and the late Christopher Hitchens, Daniel Dennett, too, to round off the four. The movement benefited having a black African-born woman as a global icon. Eventually, Hersey Ali moved to the United States and married historian Neil Ferguson in 2011. Now on the London stage, the world's most famous Muslim apostate was announcing a second conversion, this time away from atheism and to Christianity. And so too at a time of intense anxiety in the United Kingdom, as huge crowds of Islamic demonstrators gathered in the city to express support for mass killings of Jews carried out by Hamas militants. In the same presentation, Hersey Ali affirmed her unwavering support for Israel and said the Islamic extremists, it's not just Jewish babies they'll kill your babies too if you don't fit into their agenda. So this was, again, huge, huge news. Now, I thought maybe we would run through the segments in this panel discussion. And this was a good panel discussion. I gained quite a few little tidbits. Civilizational Christianity was one of the things that Alex Oz Guinness sort of laid down. Also, sort of a civilizational moment. Oz Guinness had a number of sort of concise little packets, which I like. Because those, again, pastors are word thieves. We find words out there and we sort of take them and use them when and John Anderson, I think, had a good moment that I'll play towards the end of this in terms of not just like looking back, looking forward. But I thought I'd play some of this to sort of give context, and then we can talk about the dust up that has emerged.
Maybe to flesh that out a little bit, I would say you've lived within the confines of a variety of stories. And so let's expound on that a little bit. Tell me your theory of story, and maybe you could reflect a little bit, if you would, on what...
Now again, better story was sort of the theme of the first day, and this came out in the first day, even though, as Rafe and I talked about yesterday, how well did they really develop this story idea in part of it? But again, that's why the shape of this panel discussion as it was.
Different stories you've inhabited and what the consequences of that have been for you.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Let me just start by saying a story is also the moment. And it's a moment when you're forced to make choices.
I realize it's a little low. I'm trying to boost the sound a little bit without getting distortion.
So in my background, I obviously was raised with the story that gave meaning to my parents and my grandparents over generations. But what was always clear was that you always had God on your side. There was the story we were told was the story of this is God's purpose for you, for all of us. The answers were a given.
Now, I really like the way she sort of lays this out, because how can we talk about this? There is sort of a generic religious effect that many religions have, not all religions, but the Abrahamic religions, Islam, Judaism, Christianity, by virtue of the shape from the Hebrew scriptures, can afford a real sense of providence. And all of the religions sort of have that. And so someone raised in Islam, depending again on the brand of Islam, would likely feel that this is a thing. So she was raised in this religion. She was raised, it sounds like, in a reasonably good household. She embraced the religion from her parents. That was sort of her first draft. She writes about this in her piece. Now, she went on to write this piece, and it's this piece that really has sort of caused the firestorm in Unheard. In 2002, I discovered a 1927 lecture by Bertrand Russell entitled Why I Am Not a Christian. I did not cross my mind as I read it that one day, nearly a century after he delivered this to the South London branch of the National Secular Society, I would be compelled to write an essay with precisely the opposite title. The year before, I had publicly condemned the terrorist attacks of 19 men who had hijacked passenger jets and crashed them into the Twin Towers in New York. They had done it in the name of my religion, Islam. I was a Muslim then, although not a practicing one. If I truly condemned their action, then where did that leave me? The underlying principle that justified the attacks were religious, after all. The idea of jihad or holy war against infidels. Was it possible for me, for many members of the Muslim community, simply to distance myself from the action and horrific results? At the time, there were many eminent leaders in the West, politicians, scholars, journalists, and other experts, who insisted that the terrorists were motivated by reasons other than the ones they had and their leader Osama bin Laden had articulated so clearly. So Islam had an alibi. This excuse-making was not only condemning towards Muslims, it also gave many Westerners a chance to deny to retreat into denial, blaming the error of U.S. policy that was easier than contemplating the possibility that they were confronted with a religious war. And it's interesting, sort of this, well, let's sort of soften our tone against people who've done a horrendous thing because they don't really understand. There's sort of an infantilization that goes with that as well. We have seen similar tendency in the past 5 years as millions of people sympathetic to the plight of Gazans seek to rationalize the October 7 terrorist attack as a justified response to the policies of the Israeli government. When I read Russell's lecture, I found my cognitive dissonance easing. It was a relief to adopt an attitude of skepticism towards religious doctrine, discard my faith in God, and declare that no such entity existed. Best of all, I could reject the existence of hell and the danger of everlasting punishment. Russell's assertion that religion is based primarily on fear resonated with me. I'd lived too long in terror of all the gruesome punishments that awaited me. While I had abandoned all the rational reasons for believing in God, that irrational fear of hellfire still lingered. Russell's conclusion thus came as something of a relief. When I die, I shall rot. Nice upgrade. To understand why I became an atheist 20 years ago, you first need to understand the kind of Muslim I had been. I was a teenager when the Muslim Brotherhood penetrated my community in Nairobi, Kenya in 1985. I don't think that I had ever undergone religious practice before coming to the Brotherhood. I had endured the ritual of ablutions, washing, prayer, fasting, as tedious and pointless. The preaching of the Muslim Brotherhood changed this. They articulated a direction, a straight path, a purpose, a work towards admission into Allah's paradise after death. The method, the Prophet's instruction manual of do's and don'ts, the halal and the haram, as a detailed supplement to the Quran, the hadith spelled out how to put into practice the difference between right and wrong, good and evil, God and the devil. Now, meaning, okay, it's a meaning crisis. Well, the Muslim Brotherhood is resolving her meaning crisis. The rituals seem pointless. It seems like rote religion. Now, here is something she can really sink her teeth into. The Brotherhood preachers left nothing to the imagination. They gave us a choice. Strive to live by the Prophet's manual and reap the glorious rewards in the hereafter. On this earth, meanwhile, the greatest possible achievement possible was to die as a martyr for the sake of Allah. The alternative, indulging in the pleasures of this world, was to earn Allah's wrath and be condemned to an eternal life in hellfire. Some of the worldly pleasures they were decrying included reading novels, listening to music, dancing, and going to the cinema, all of which I was ashamed to admit that I adored. The most striking quality of the Muslim Brotherhood was their ability to transform me and my fellow teenagers from pastors, believers, into activists almost overnight. They didn't just say things or pray for things, they did things. As girls, we donned the burqa, swore off Western fashion and makeup. Boys cultivated their facial hair to the greatest extent possible. They wore the white dress, like the tab worn in Arab countries, and had their trousers shortened above their ankle bones. They operated in groups and volunteered our services and charity to the poor, the old, the disabled, and the weak. We urged fellow Muslims to pray and demand that non-Muslims convert to Islam. During Islamic study sessions, we shared with the preachers in charge of the session our worries. For example, what should we do about the friends we loved and felt loyal to, but who refused to accept our dawah, invitation to the faith, our dawah? In response, we were reminded repeatedly about the clarity of the Prophet's instructions. We were told in no uncertain terms that we could not be loyal to Allah and Muhammad while also maintaining friendships and loyalty towards unbelievers. If they explicitly rejected our summons to Islam, we were to hate and curse them. Here, a special hatred was reserved for one subset of unbelievers, the Jews. We cursed the Jews multiple times a day and expressed horror, disgust, and anger at the litany of offenses that they had allegedly committed. The Jews had betrayed our prophet. They had occupied the Holy Mosque in Jerusalem. They continued to spread corruption of the heart, mind, and soul. Now, it's interesting because the Brett Weinstein critique of religion comes up regularly. And one of the points that I usually make about Brett's critique is that religions are constantly updating themselves. Even religions that are sort of always looking back at their former source material, but they're still reading it through a new interpretive lens. That's pretty much what religions do. Now let's go back to our story.
I became dissatisfied with that story, I think as most people here know. And I picked a different story when I was old enough, I thought, and capable enough to make a choice. And again, I think we find ourselves today, right now, in a moment where we have to make a choice and we have to make a moral choice. I sit here and I can say today, given what's going on, I support Israel. No buts, no ifs, unequivocally. That is a moral choice. And it is based on the story of the civilization that I adopted. And the civilization that I adopted, Western civilization, is threatened with a story from the civilization that I left. And I think for me, these are the two stories of my time. And there are times when I feel depressed and think, why on earth do I have to be, you know, why do I have to deal with this? But there are times like now when I really feel strengthened and emboldened and say, I have children and I'm fighting for the civilization that I adopted for my children and for your children. And we have to fight. And it makes me extremely optimistic that this room today is full of people who see that and who want to fight back. That's
what,
story.
What do you think?
Okay, let's talk about a couple of things, because there's some things running through this story. And this is especially going to come up with a conversation with respect to new atheists or atheism. Because part of what sort of premises life in the West is this idea, it's sort of a naivete, this innocence that there is something sort of like regular life with which is not religious. That, well, regular life is what? Is basically how people in the West live. It's consuming Netflix, it's eating the foods that you want, it's looking for the job that you want. It's now I'm old enough to see this regular life narrative sort of change over the years, because in the 1970s and 80s when I was growing up, regular life included getting married and having a family. Regular life for many, at least in the United States, included going to church. Going to church was part of regular life. I've spoken before about how this transformation happened at the end of the Cold War, where before, during the Cold War, in order to be a good American, this is sort of like Ayn Rand's positive, neutral, negative world. In order to be a good American, you were a church-going American. Maybe you went to a mainline church. Part of the reason that Americans went to church is because communists were godless. And so we sort of resisted godless communists. Fundamentalists at that point were sort of a little too extreme, but, you know, they were on our side, so everything was okay. A regular American, just watch the Andy Griffith Show. There's sort of being a regular American. Andy Griffith would go to church and Barney would go to church, but you didn't really see necessarily Andy Griffith and Barney having this burning passion to evangelize their neighbor. Of course, all of this begins to change in the 1970s, where read Chuck Colson's Born Again. Jimmy Carter was elected as the first born again American president. And that whole born again thing sort of signals the shift from the mainline to the evangelical in terms of the self-conscious Christian. And at that point, maybe you begin to see this shift from a positive to a neutral. And of course, 9/11 just sort of rips that whole thing apart. And religious fundamentalism is what caused the attack. Therefore, well, we don't have a lot of Islamist fundamentalists here in the United States, so then let's attack the Christian fundamentalists and go after them. And if you go back through the Justin Brierley's catalog of unbelievable podcasts, pull up the one, I've played it before on the channel, pull up the one with Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins is talking to someone who identifies as in the Jewish faith and someone in the Christian faith. Richard Dawkins at one point basically says to him, I don't mean Christians like you. It's just when Christians get into politics, because regular life means that your religion sort of stays over here and you only bring regular life things into politics and in terms of authority that can only be had by science. That's the only ground for this. And it's quite clear from her story that she was sort of a, from an American perspective, you would look back, she was sort of a regular Muslim girl, which means, well, moderate. Well, maybe you could dress the way you wanted to and you could wear the makeup you wanted to. And of course, I'm by no means an expert in this, but that kind of Islam, you have to understand Islam in the story, in the history of the 20th century, and the fall of the Ottoman Empire after the First World War, and the dismemberment of that. And of course, Turkey takes this transformation into a secular society, and the Hagia Sophia becomes a museum. And that's probably one of the biggest artifact tells of a mosque becomes a museum. When I was in the UK last week, it was fun. It got some these great museums, and I went into this one museum, and this museum in Oxford is basically, it was made to look like a new cathedral. I'll pull up a picture. Here it is. It was built in the 19th century. And you can see, but this is a cathedral of glass and light. There's no stained glass that sort of filters the light coming in and gives it a Christian hue through the stories in the stained glass. This is clear glass, and it's not made of stone, it's made of steel. And now, by virtue of the new politically incorrect age, all of the really cool stuff is brought to the back section, back behind these doors. And if you really want to find the shrunken heads, you have to sort of look to it. But you can see that museums are sort of these cathedrals to the world of reason. And now we are leaving superstition behind, and here we have Bacon, and we have Aristotle, and we have we don't have saints on the walls. We have these saints of the Enlightenment on the walls. Let's see if I got any pictures of the back room. No, this was in Oxford. Really, really interesting and terrifically interesting museum.
In your own life, what do you think the differences are between the times when you're feeling more despair, let's say, and more hopelessness, and the times that you're feeling more optimistic?
The hopelessness for me comes when people make excuses for evil. When you have three weekends in a row, 100,000 people who live here, who've grown up here, and who enjoy the blessings of this civilization, march in London and make excuses for evil and side with evil. It makes me despair because the rest of us don't stand up to it. But it also gives me hope to come here and say, let's stand up for it. Because now we know what evil looks like and we know exactly what we're facing. It's not only the Jewish babies that they're beheading. They will behead your babies, Jewish or not, if you don't fit into their story.
Okay, I have one more question for you on that side of things. Now, you grew up in one story, within the confines of one story, let's say, and you said that there was a time in your life where you chose another. And I would say, what do you think? Why did you make the decision that you did make to value the latter story, the Western story that you identified with? Why did you make that decision? And how do you justify it?
It was very easy to make the decision because it's a Western story, and Western civilization is a story that cherishes life, that goes to great lengths to preserve life. The story I left was a story that cherishes death. My life as a woman meant nothing. I was a thing to be traded, to be used, and then to be discarded. And once I found out the differences, I adopted this story that is all about the preservation of life, not only for people in the West, but all human life. That's the story of the West. That's a story that's not told.
John, Ayan has made the...
Okay, so what some people like, so Michael Shermer he responded to this, and he said, you know, I've known her for a number of years, and what a lot of sort of celebrity atheists want to assert here is that, and with a certain amount of reason, well, has her story really changed? Because... an atheist will basically say, no, there's regular life and religion is this thing over here on the side. And that's pretty much what he says. Nothing Ion has written in her essay changes my evaluation of her as a heroic figure. I simply think she is mistaken. We are all about a great many things. Maybe I am wrong here and she is right, but I think reason and history prove otherwise. Let me explain in the spirit of respect of what is online here, starting from the subtitle of Ion's essay, Atheism Can't Equip Us for Civilizational War. She's right, but not in the way she thinks. Atheism per se can't equip anyone for anything because it's not a belief system or worldview. Okay. But then, please describe for me the first... Okay, let's say she begins life as a little girl in an Islamic family, and part of what she was absorbing in that family, very subtly and implicitly, was something that sort of initiated the antibodies in Islamic fundamentalism. If you go back and look at the story of bin Laden, and part of what they complained about is, okay, American troops on Saudi soil. Now, regular life, you would say, well, what's wrong with that? Soil is soil. Oh, no. There's holy soil and there's common soil. In other words, this whole idea of there's regular life, that isn't as regular as you think. That itself is the product of a great line of history. And so when she makes her transition from sort of being raised a Muslim and thinking that the washings and the prayer and all of this stuff that she's doing is sort of pointless, she's already living deeply impacted by secularism, which grows out of Christianity and I think is some of the sneakiest Jesus smuggling that has ever been perpetrated on the history of the world. She's already being deeply impacted by secularism. So then the Muslim Brotherhood comes along and says, oh, no. Let's show you the true path. And now suddenly, this meaning crisis, which is always sort of lurking beneath secularism, now she's sort of radicalized and part of the Muslim Brotherhood. But those values that were communicated into her by secularity were already there. And so when 9/11 happens, boom, those antibodies get triggered. And hey, wait a minute. People should be able to live regular life, to be able to, and you can find this in the book of Deuteronomy, to grow up and to grow old and to have children and to be able to plant your field and to, this is sort of what regular life should be in many respects. And so then she's radicalized, and when she sees the fruit of this kind of Islam, well, then she turns and she has a worldview change again. Now, it's sort of a reversion back to the first one in some ways, but now it's radicalized. And so when Michael Shermer says it's not a belief system or a worldview, I don't think you're being honest. Because the whole point of New Atheism, and again, listen to Justin Brierley's podcast, the whole point of New Atheism was, in many ways, delivering people from one worldview to another. It wasn't just getting rid of some incidental aspect. Don't talk to me about the Christians in America who basically listened to Sam Harris and got rid of this stuff and now began doing other things in Sunday, that there was no worldview transformation. There clearly was. It was the whole point of New Atheism. These guys acted like evangelists propagating their idea. And then it's sort of the ultimate Mott and Bailey move to say, oh, no, it's not a worldview. People don't act that way. They certainly act as if it's a worldview. And so here again, we see some of what happened with, I think, Tom Holland. And why Tom Holland was so important in this story. But we can't fight off these formidable forces unless we can answer the question of, what is it that unites us? The response that God is dead seems insufficient. So too does the attempt to find solace in the rules-based liberal international order. Now again, this whole worldview that when she gets to the Netherlands and her eyes are open and she's like, people are allowed to live their lives. Well, where does that come from? Well, it came from, let's look at some of the markers, the United Nations, Human Rights Declaration. Where did that come from? It came from WASPy, North American Protestant mainline vision for life. Ideas of equality. These undergird the American Civil Rights Movement, which sort of is this great awakening which opens the eyes of people around the world. This is not sort of an empty thing. All of these beliefs are there. They're just so implicit and built into the worldview. It's like the old joke during the racial reconciliation era that white people don't think they have a culture. Atheists don't think they have a worldview. And this point has been made again and again and again and again. And so to say, well, atheists don't have a worldview, it's like, well, then tell me about all of the conversions that new atheism succeeded in bringing to former Christians and people who used to go to church. Yes, it has a worldview, and that's what's going on. And basically she's saying that, it is a worldview. The only credible answer, I believe, lies in our desire to uphold the legacy of Judeo-Christian tradition. That legacy consists of an elaborate set of ideas and institutions designed to safeguard human life, freedom, and dignity. And if you listen to, there's a whole bunch of videos that came out while I was traveling that I don't know if I'll ever get a chance to go back over, but one worthwhile is listening to Sam Harris and Eric Weinstein on trigonometry talk to Francis and Constantine, because what's amazing is that you say Sam Harris doesn't have a worldview. How would you describe his worldview? I mean, Sam Harris is basically getting almost bloodthirsty with respect to Hamas and certain kinds of jihadis. And Eric Weinstein is sort of the voice of reason in that, saying, oh, back off a little bit, buddy. How are you going to differentiate between the people who are actually on the planes and those who are just sort of swept up in weaker distillations of that worldview? As Tom Holland has shown in his marvelous book Dominion, all sorts of apparently secular freedoms of the market, of the conscience, of the press, find their roots in Christianity. So I've come to realize that Russell and my atheist friends failed to see the wood for the trees. The wood is the civilization built into Judeo-Christian traditions. It is the story of the West, warts and all. Russell's critique of those contradictions in Christian doctrine is serious, but also too narrow in scope. For instance, he gave his lecture in a room full of former or at least doubting Christians in a Christian country. Think about how unique that was nearly a century ago and how rare it is still in the non-Western civilization. Could a Muslim philosopher stand before any audience in a Muslim country then or now and deliver a lecture with the title, Why I'm Not a Muslim? In fact, a book with that title exists, written by an ex-Muslim, and the author published it in America under a pseudonym. It would have been too dangerous otherwise. In other words, there is no such thing as regular life. Code is built into all we do, and the code that we are working out, even in secular Western countries, is Christian code. That's basically where she came to, and eventually said, I might as well get closer to the source code. And well, let's continue to hear what she has to say. So we're going to pick it up here with John Anderson sort of finishing his thing. And again, if you go back to my ARC Day 1 video and something that I talked about with Rafe, there's this real tension in ARC about, okay, liberalism, but is it just going back to liberalism, or must, in fact, this also continue to evolve?
We're going to respect the voting citizens again and their clear will and intent, because we're the arc of responsible citizens. We want to reinvigorate a citizenship where people feel alienated and patronised, because they are being alienated and patronised by the expertocracy. And we have got to believe that instinctively, particularly if they've got leadership, we can draw out the better angels in our nature, because we all have the better angels and the selfish angels, and try and ensure that democracy works again properly and we work forward on a basis of restored trust. Because nothing is more corrosive to our societies than the breakdown of trust. Trust in individuals, trust in politicians, trust in institutions. But I want to say to you, in my view, worst of all, the breakdown of trust in our driving beliefs and ideals and values. And if we can restore those.
Now, again, this is part of the reason why she's on stage there, because this is something she's been calling to for a long time. I listened, again, I've not followed her career hardly at all. I listened to her on Jordan Peterson, and the message was clear in the first 10 minutes when she was out, and it was basically that, why has the West lost confidence in itself? Unless it finds that confidence again, it's going to lose it because others are going to come and take it from you. Okay, well, we can talk about strategy with respect to that, but that's still the message she's giving. I mean, the real transformation has been that she's sort of been working her way down the historical legacy train and realized that secularity was basically this masterclass in Jesus smuggling, and maybe she should get to know the source of this civilization that she so esteems and is very afraid of losing because she's lived out the consequence of it being lost.
Look, there'll be those who want to paint us as reactionary. I don't want to be seen as reactionary. I don't want to say we go back to creating yesterday's societies. There were things wrong with it. But I do want to say that the old verities, the old truths, a proper understanding of the worth and dignity of all, held in suspension with an understanding of our failings, realism as opposed to utopianism, must be the basis of freedom moving on, whatever it turns out to look like in the modern age.
Ayanne, maybe I'll close with you, if you don't mind. And so you, early in your life, relatively early in your life, you moved away from a totalizing religious view of the world. And I don't exactly know into what you then moved, whether that was a secular humanism, but what I'm hearing from you now, and I believe this is also the case with your husband, is that you have come to a new understanding of the existence of the transcendent per se, and also of your relationship with it. Now, first of all, do I have that right? And second of all, like, is that the movement that you have made, and if so, why?
So I rebelled against a transcendent, a concept of God, of a God that now manifests itself in, you know, the Iranian regime, Hamas, ISIS. That was the God I grew up with. That was the story that I grew up with. I rebelled against that. And then when I was bold enough to say, and this was in the Netherlands, I don't want any of that. I didn't convert to Christianity. I didn't convert to another religion or another God. I carried with me this idea, the three-letter word of God stands just for evil. And my best friends became Sam Harris and Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins. These are people I still love and adore. And I think over time, I'm now 53, and so when I made this, when I was in this state of rebellion, it started for me when I was 32 years old. Over time, I've come to realize, and I wish Christopher was alive today to comment on what we're going through, was we were actually having a conversation about, in my view, the wrong conversation. Does God exist? You know, it was the world built in 6 days. Do we believe in fairy tales? And that was the wrong conversation to have.
The point she's making right there is important because, again, if you go back to a lot of the civilizational fight happens on the religious layer. And the dominant worldview battle since the end of the 19th century in many places has been the fundamentalist modernist fight within the Christian frame. And if you look at that, the history of which I know mostly in the American context, American fundamentalists were not blowing up buildings. American fundamentalists were waging their culture war as Christians to try to get the culture back. And this reverberates in how many different ways, the Scopes trial, young earth creationism, all of this stuff that happened. And in many respects, Islam takes down the towers and everybody decides to go to war against Jerry Falwell. And it's like, you're really hard pressed to put Jerry Falwell sort of in line with the people who took down the towers. But that's sort of the way that they aligned it. And again, back to the Unbelievable podcast with Richard Dawkins, where they're trying to talk about this stuff. And Richard Dawkins at some point just basically says, "You're not the Christians I'm worried about." And Richard Dawkins is worried about Christians that are going to take evolutionary science out of public school, yada, yada, yada. And for the most part, what I see even today is with sort of a lot of the real anxiety about the new Speaker of the House is in America over here, there's all of this hand-wringing about, well, it's the theocrats that are going to seize power in America and turn this into a theocracy. It's not going to happen. It is not going to happen. And for all of the anxiety about Christians somehow ruling the country via their fairy tales, let's not forget that probably one of the last, for 2 points. Number one, is Donald Trump the theocrat you're anxious about? He called Donald Trump a lot of things. Christian fundamentalist? Not one of them. That he gained support from Christian fundamentalists? You can have that conversation. But Donald Trump himself is hardly a Christian fundamentalist. Number two, the last time we saw a significant presidential decision that at least was made publicly with respect to supernatural causes was Nancy Reagan jiggering Ronnie's schedule because of her astrologist. And this has been part of the downfall of new atheism that, and you hear people sort of trot out this Chesterton quote again and again and again. But if you look at Clay Routledge, Chesterton quote about the believe in anything, but if you look at Clay Routledge, all of the, and you listen to Peter Boghossian, this substitutionary hypothesis that, yeah, they're just going to find other things that believe in that certain amount of sort of people who imagine themselves to be strict rationalists. Again, you'd say that's not a worldview. That is, in fact, the worldview you're promoting. And I mean, I think John Vervaeke is dead on right. The worldview doesn't work. Jordan Peterson is right. That worldview is going away because people just don't seem to operate that way at all. Look at Peter Boghossian's conversation with Silverman. People don't operate that way at all. And they might think, oh, some of us really intellectual people can operate in that way. And I just look at them and say, BS, because you're simply out of touch with the layers of civilizational drafts that have become the regular world you imagine you live in without religion. It just isn't true.
The right conversation to have, as I said earlier, was to compare what we as human beings, the transcendence that we have imagined and developed over centuries. And so now I can say I am proudly of Judeo-Christian religion without having to waste your time about, do I really think that the world was built in 6 days? Do I really believe every word in the Bible? No, but I do believe that that's Judeo-Christian tradition. And what it has brought forth is, those are the values that I aspire to, the values by which I live. I was called a Christian by Roger Scruton in 2008, and I said, Roger, no, I'm not a Christian. And he said, but you act like a Christian, and you behave like a Christian, therefore you are a Christian. And I think that's exactly...
Okay, we're going to have to talk about this, because what she's basically doing, what Roger Scruton said to her, is basically what Jordan Peterson was saying to Sam Harris in 2018. You are a Christian. Why? You're standing on the accumulation of all of this Christianity saying, I don't know what I'm standing on. But that's what you are.
Exactly what I would like to say to Richard Dawkins. It's, you act like, I've been to, you know, choral music with him, which he enjoys very much. And he's one of the most Christian people I know. And so I think we've been having this, time.
And Jordan's like, I've been saying this to them and they don't like it, but that's what it is.
Wasting debates, and you know, you grow up, I matured, here I am. But what the quotes that you just had about, you know, Western civilization is a cut flower and cut flowers die. That is true. Cut flowers do die, but what we have in terms of Western civilization is a lot of seed packets. And I want to send you off with these seed packets, which you find in libraries, which you find in, you know, wise people like you, like Roger Scruton, like all these other people that I mentioned, in statues. We have the remnants, the symbols of Western heritage. And their seeds, and all we have to do, those of us who inherited it and enjoy it, is to go and seed them, grow them, nurture them, water them, and when they're attacked, fight for them.
Thank you. Yeah.
And so, in many ways, so some of the new atheists say, she hasn't changed that much. And they have a point. She hasn't changed that much, but she's been working her way down the tree. And, of course, if you listen to Justin Brierley's podcast, and if you look at the 5 years of conversations that I've been having, if you look at downstream from the Jordan Peterson thing, people are working their way down the tree, and they're beginning to look down at what they're standing on, and they're like, oh my goodness, I'm standing on Christianity. What am I going to do about that? Now, a friend sent me this podcast. I had never heard of the podcast, the Danny Miranda podcast. Don't know how big or small it is. Seems to have some big names on, so maybe he's got some. So I don't do iTunes. I don't look at podcast ratings. I don't know how big or small any of these things are. And I never heard of David Perel, but I guess he's a name that some people will recognize. And he talked about his conversion to Christianity. And again, people are converting to some pretty potent forms of Christianity all over the place. And so what we're seeing here in terms of this definition of Christianity is some of what David Perel talked about in this podcast.
And with that, you can think what you want. But if you're not going to be a believing Christian, have some good answers for why. Maybe read a few of the books, know what it actually says. And most people I speak with haven't read the Bible. I'm not talking about the whole thing, but read one of the Gospels, a few of Paul's letters, some of the Old Testament. Just get a general handle on what it actually says.
And in other words, there's a tremendous amount of ignorance currently in the culture about Christianity. Bible knowledge, which used to be something that was sort of taught in the UK, something that was known in the United States, not necessarily by the government, but by the church, all of this stuff has sort of dropped.
Christianity is bad PR in the culture for good reason. And I forget what the third one is, but knowing what the Bible says, Christianity is bad PR in the culture. There's, you know, a few things. Let's clean this part up.
We can three.
Yeah. I mean, just, yeah, I don't know. I just got caught.
It's all good.
And people have church hurt, you know, they have bad experiences around faith and I get it, but I don't worship the church. I don't worship people who are Christians. I don't worship the Bible. I worship Jesus and I try to follow Jesus. And that's what I care about. And one thing that really helped me was realizing that there are way more Christians in the world than I realized and way fewer Christians. There are way more in that, in some sense.
And this is the point that I was getting at. There are way more Christians in the world and there are way fewer. Well, what do you mean by that?
Everyone in the West is a Christian, in that Judeo-Christian ideas underpin Western morality. Look at how the Romans treated babies. Look at how modern Westerners treat babies. There's so many examples of this. Our sense of morality is Christianity without Christ in a lot of ways. Mm. So we're all shaped by these ideas. And on the other hand, there's way fewer Christians than I ever realized in that, oh, 33, 40, 50% of America is Christian. America is a very Christian nation. But one of the things that really helped me was to ask how many of those people who are Christians actually lay their life down for the word of God, for Jesus, for what they believe. And the answer is very small. And so as I thought about, am I interested in doing this? Is this something that's attractive to me? I only looked at those people's lives. And I said, are the fruits of the Spirit showing up in their life in a way that surpasses my life? And the answer was an unequivocal yes. So when I thought about more people, that got me interested. When I thought about fewer people, that pulled me in. And then back to the question about choice. It wasn't a choice at all. It was supernatural, whatever happened.
It's really cool, and it's been remarkable to be taken in by you in the journey, and I appreciate your invitations to go to church, and I will continue going because I'm interested as well. And
this is the way it works. Now it's really helpful to understand that the Muslim Brotherhood offered young Ayan, I don't know if I'm saying her name right. I went to the Netherlands. I couldn't say any of the words right. I went to Germany. I couldn't say any of the words right. And I went to England and Scotland and couldn't say any of the words right there either. I just say the words like an American. But so she gets radicalized by the Muslim Brotherhood. And well, this is a mission. But then discovers that the heart of this mission is bloodthirsty. And David Perel looks at these Christians that are willing to give their life, but at the center of that religion is a man being killed by his enemies and his rivals, praying on the cross, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. So a friend of mine on Twitter said, yeah, but the subtitle... Atheism can't equip us for civilizational war. What does that mean? Well, how do Christians fight? How do Christians fight a culture war? And my advice for that is read the Gospels. How did Jesus fight his culture war? Because his culture war was at least as hot as ours. Because, you know, you could get stoned by your own people. You could get crucified by the Romans. You could, you know, on and on and on. How did Jesus fight a culture war? And when you look at how Jesus fought the culture war, people would say, well, that will never work. Yeah, but here we are 2,000 years later, and he's still turning people's lives upside down. And so... part of what happens, which was so amazing after this, is that suddenly everyone is she a Christian? And you have all of these atheists, new atheists sort of saying, well, she's not really a Christian. It's like, you're the judge of that now? She doesn't really believe in God. Well, I don't know what she does and doesn't believe. And, you know, I've long had a sort of a bone to pick about the framing of this too. Because, and I think, again, Jordan Peterson was right all along in that, you know, what the chattering, to pull in some Jonathan Haidt too, what the chattering rider on the elephant is saying, well, that's what we listen to and that's what we can hear. And everybody's freaking out about what she said. But what really matters is something far deeper. It's the axiomatic. And so on one hand, you've got a lot of people saying, I don't believe in God, who are acting out, at least for a generation or three, what a lot of people acted out who, in fact, did believe in God and had that sort of broad confidence that is common beneath these Abrahamic religions. But the details matter. And as the further you go up, it's sort of like the further you go down. And at some point, you're going to have to wrestle with the kinds of choices that religious people have to wrestle with. So I saw some of what Colin Wright was saying. Now, Colin Wright grew up just up in the foothills from here. He's come to a meetup meeting here. Colin and I have spoken in the past. He was on for a podcast, so you know I consider him an acquaintance, and I wouldn't have any problem considering him a friend if we had probably had more time together. But he's, you know, again, he's sort of in this atheist camp, and he's sort of in that worldview. And yes, it is a worldview. People are taking issue with me, saying I'm disappointed that Ian became a Christian. I think this stems from the simple fact that Christians view Christianity as inherently good and therefore can't imagine why anyone would be disappointed with that. That's pretty much what everyone thinks about their worldview, because if they didn't think their worldview was good, they'd probably change it. Well, not everyone believes what you believe. Well, that's right. My disappointment stems from the simple fact that I believe atheism, the lack of belief in God or gods, is the more rational position to hold. Now, he clearly thinks that it's a worldview, because the nature of transcendence, let's get into this theory language instead of religious language, the nature of transcendence matters in terms of your worldview. Therefore, it shouldn't come as a surprise when someone moves from a position I perceive as more rational non-belief into a position I perceive as less rational belief in God, and would result in some level of disappointment. There's that whole tribal dynamic. When she states she's a Christian, and this you got to be really careful with, all the Christians say, hurrah, we win one. You can find plenty of YouTubers out there, you know, taking a victory lap. But let me warn you that very quickly, once you're on the Christian side of the line, you very well may quickly be subjected to, you're the wrong kind of Christian, you have the wrong kinds of beliefs, or yada, 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 because the intramural fighting within on this side of the line is sometimes even more fierce than fighting about the line between Christian and non-Christian. Because that sort of funny nature of the line that David Perel noted is alive and well in Christian communities. And so, Christians, let's have a little bit of grace for one another. Let's actually believe what we say we believe, that God is finally the judge, not us. And why don't we leave it to God and the Holy Spirit and her local pastor to, you know, help her steward these next journeys of her life. Just saying. I'm sure you, as a Christian, could feel some, if not great deal, of disappointment if a high-profile Christian you admired suddenly announced that they'd lost their faith and turned atheist. That never happens. We've been watching this for a while, and it's usually artists and Christian contemporary music. What's the guy's name? John Steingard? There's plenty of them out there, okay? So, yeah, the whole tribal game. And I guess part of what's behind my channel all along is I've never thought the tribal game is exactly as it appears. And that isn't to say that these professions of faith, one way or another, with respect to the Christian line, are insignificant or unimportant. I would not say that. It's just that they are never quite as simple or easy as they appear. Because if you listen to her, it's basically a natural evolution, probably a more studied evolution than a lot of people running around with this idea that atheism isn't a worldview, really. And white people don't have a culture. That wouldn't puzzle me at all. Clearly, you wouldn't be a Christian if you didn't believe Christianity was true and good, and so it's understandable that you'd feel disappointed. Absolutely. And then he goes on to go back and forth. Colin goes on here that, well, I think many people may have also incorrectly interpreted my disappointment in Ian turning Christian as a meaning that I do not like Christians or think less of people. No, Colin came to my church, sat down over here in the sanctuary, had an absolutely wonderful conversation. He and I had a two-hour YouTube conversation, which you go back through the conversations, you can look it up. Colin is a very nice guy, and like many people in America, James Lindsley talked about this quite openly, is surrounded by Christians, knows Christians. He grew up in a part of Sacramento that has some of the largest Christian churches, and so He knows that Christians can be nice people, just like a lot of Christians know that atheists can be nice people. And we're not going to fight, okay? We're not going to do it. This couldn't be further from the truth. Most of my friends are not atheists. I get along well with Christians and people of other religious faiths just fine. I judge people as individuals. If I'm being totally honest, given my fervent anti-woke stance, I tend to get along with and enjoy the company of Christians and people of other religious faiths way better than most atheists. Given the prevalence of wokeness among atheists right now, if I was given the choice to hang out with one or two friends and all I knew about them was that one was an atheist and the other was a Christian, I'd choose to hang out with the Christian. And I think this is a big part of what is happening now. Because atheism plus turned into the kind of sort of irrational violation of the regular life, this sort of low-resolution assumption about how the world is, which is itself, of course, a worldview, that they've sort of become their own kind of fundamentalists, and increasingly people are like, I don't want to be with you. Okay, what is regular life? Well, regular life is in many ways not that uncommon from the Andy Griffith Show, not that uncommon from The Positive World, with a whole lot of Jesus sort of smuggled in under the sign of secularity. That is sort of regular life in America. So, yeah, I think this will be yet another chapter. I think, I don't know exactly how many chapters Justin Brierley has planned for his podcast, but reserve one for her. And to the Christians, okay, if you're going to celebrate her crossing the line, be at least a little generous about the development of her faith. Because the truth is, not all of us had the privilege of being born into a Christian family. I was. And it was a wonderful Christian family. And my parents, my mother is and my father was, an absolutely delightful, life-giving, generous, godly Christian people. And the community that I grew up in and the church that I grew up in was just an absolutely wonderful Christian church full of people who loved people of all kinds of different backgrounds. In the midst of the racial reconciliation movement of the 60s and 70s, in the midst of the counterculture, people would come to our church because we were a little different from some of the more uptight churches. And the church learned to love people well. And if there's one thing that you can take from Jesus, is that you're commanded to love your neighbor as yourself, all the way up to and including your enemies. And so all of that has to condition figuring out how to conduct a culture war. Because how did Jesus win his culture war? By giving his life. And so David Perel, when he looks at Christians and says, we should play that again, because he said it really well.
Today's bad PR in the culture, there's, you know, a few things. Let's clean this part up.
We can, three.
Yeah, I mean, just, yeah, I don't know. I just got caught.
It's all good.
And people have church hurt. You know, they have bad experiences around faith, and I get it. But I don't worship the church. I don't worship people who are Christians. I don't worship the Bible. I worship Jesus, and I try to follow Jesus. And that's what I care about. And one thing that really helped me was realizing that there are way more Christians in the world than I realized, and way fewer Christians. There are way more in that, in some sense, everyone in the West is a Christian, in that Judeo-Christian ideas underpin Western morality. Look at how the Romans treated babies. Look at how modern Westerners treat babies. There's so many examples of this. Our sense of morality is Christianity without Christ in a lot of ways. Mm. So we're all shaped by these ideas. And on the other hand, there's way fewer Christians than I ever realized, in that, 33, 40, 50% of America is Christian. America is a very Christian nation. But one of the things that really helped me was to ask, how many of those people who are Christians actually lay their life down for the Word of God, for Jesus, for what they believe? And the answer is very small. And so as I thought about, am I interested in doing this? Is this something that's attractive to me? I only looked at those people's lives. And I said, are the fruits of the Spirit showing up in their life in a way?
And you might wonder what those fruits of the Spirit are. You can read about them in the book of Galatians. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control.
That surpasses my life? And the answer was an unequivocal yes. So when I thought about more people, that got me interested. When I thought about fewer people, that pulled me in.
When I thought about more people, that got me interested. Even more people looking down at the layers of civilization and Christianity beneath us. But when I thought about fewer people, then sort of the heroic hunger in me welled up and thought, I want to be one of those Christians who, when the saints go marching in, I want to be one of their number. You can listen to a Sarah Grove song like that. So there it is. There's my video about this whole, this might be, who knows? That's why when you have a conference like this, you have no idea what this conference is going to do, how this conference is going to play into history. Something happens in your life, you don't think a thing of it. And a little ways down the road, something else happened. It's like, oh. So here it is. Leave a comment. Let me know what you think.